Well, thank you, Ray. And I apologize for the long title. One of our cohorts, Bob, this loves long titles. And as Bill was taking away wildlife habitat, we're putting it back. So we're kind of just the opposite here. Yes. But our overall objective is that we want to get modern agriculture, conservation, and wildlife all on the same page. Because as you know, we've been going in the opposite directions for 50 years. And we thought the best way to do this is to look at Northern bobwhite quail management, because it's at the bottom of the food chain, and it's also called the sacred bird by a lot of people, and we've seen the population crash. So if we can develop habitat that's good for the bobwhite quail, it will fall into place for rabbits, for mourning doves, and other animals that are non-crop destructive. So the first thing that we needed to do was evaluate what we had out there. Now, we don't have a pointer, do we, Ray?
Use your mouth.
Oh. Oh, wow. Well, we have about 200 plots and 1 to 4 acres out at the Bradford Center, with some areas that aren't suitable for field crop production or plot work. We thought that would be a great place to do some wildlife management. We haven't developed our new land like Bill has. We have 100 acres to the north, 180 acres to the south, where we can do a little bit larger plots. But we also have within these wooded draws and fence rows and what have you that we can utilize for some wildlife. So the first thing we did was have to evaluate what we had, and we used our co-author's habitat appraisal guide. We had to get that in there. And we went out to find out what we had. And what we found was that in areas that we're not using for studies, like you see over here, this is a study, but over here, we were farming up to the fence row like everybody else in Missouri does. And this wooded draw that we have, what's raised 50, 60 feet wide, is full of brush and trees that really have no economic or wildlife value whatsoever, but we also have a meandering stream through this. So this really didn't have very much wildlife potential. And we also had some native warm season grasses in these areas on the main farm that we thought we were managing great by burning them every spring. Well, all that does is get it thicker and thicker and thicker, and we wind up with nothing but escape cover. But we also have areas that we don't use for research, and these are areas that are grown up in tall fescue. We keep this mowed, it looks pretty. But what we found out was this area was a great nesting ground for the bobwhite quail that we destroyed every year. So we saw that there was a lot of potential that we could do with this. So one of the first things that we did was take this wooded draw that we had, and let's cut the trees out that we don't want. Let's leave, how'd I go back? Oh, wow. But we leave the trees for stream bank stabilization, and we leave the trees that are good for wildlife. Now, we worked with the forestry department. They came out and they cut 10 trees out of a quarter mile row. They thought that was great. So after they left, we went back in, actually Ray did, and cut out about 90% of the trees and brush. So what we had left was just the bare minimum that we could use for wildlife. Then we came back and planted CRP33 mixes, which is lots of forbs and legumes and a little bit of native grasses. And we went from 30 to 120 feet wide. What we did, we straightened the field out. And this gave us this variety. And then we came back with corn, soybean rotation. Oh, and this is what it looks like after 2 years. You see that we've got a nice establishment of forbs and legumes. God damn it. That looks nice. The trees are coming in. We're getting some shrubs and what have you. So this made a nice wildlife habitat. And look at the corn yield. And I apologize already. I didn't notice until Saturday night that I had cut and pasted this out of a document that was for the lay person, so I had no statistics. Sorry about that. Okay, I'm getting mad. Well, what we found out, though, is that the 30-foot CRP, this is rows from the edge of that 30-foot, there's really no change in corn yield, which we kind of expect, which was great. But what was totally surprising to us, that when we went with 60 or 120 feet, we had severe yield reductions. And we thought, what in the heck is going on? Except what we made was a playground for the deer, for the raccoons and what have you. They were destroying our crop. It was so wide, it was, hey, this is perfect habitat for us. So in conclusion on this, 30 feet's long enough. If you want to actually produce a good economic value, you need to keep your CRP 30 to 30 foot along these wooded draws for corn. Soybeans were a little bit different. We didn't see that big decrease, even though, yeah, deer were grazed on your soybeans a little bit, and we saw this yield reduction right here probably from that. Overall, after 10 or so rows, and these are 15-inch rows, the yields were back up to normal. So we really didn't see that big decrease from the soybeans. But still, 30 foot is probably optimal. All right, we also had just wooded fence rows. And we had two different... Okay. We had these, so we went with either 30-foot CRP, just like we did before, or let's go with root plowing. Because some farmers will say, I don't want to have to plant that. Why can't we just go with a root plow? So we had 36-inch root plow along the side, as well as a control. And you look at the corn, and you know, it looked about like what we expected. Look at this. This is our control, and you see it's a stair step. It takes, what, eight to ten rows before you start getting normal-looking corn again. Newell Kitchen always calls these red soils because you run in the red. You got the same inputs as the rest of the field, but your output is very, very low. But when we root plowed, we could see that we didn't really see this, that the corn was fairly even. So we thought, okay, we're going to get some nice results out of this. But what surprised us was that, look, here's our planting to the edge without root plow. Here it is with root plow. No difference. There was no difference in yield. Even though they looked different, it wasn't. And with our CP33 mix, it picked up about where we thought it would be. A little bit of decrease in the first few rows and then an increase. So what's going on here? Well, this is a north-south fence row. So and soybeans are still, and corn are still getting shaded in the morning or in the afternoon. So we took out maybe the water competition, but we didn't take out the light competition and other factors going out there. So really taking this edge out, or this root plowing, was just a waste of time. Going with the 30 foot would be a lot better. Soybeans, we didn't see that big decrease. That big change. We see back here is where the root plow is. Here's where it's not. No real difference. And the yield showed the same thing as corn, in that we got a low yield, and it took, what, 10 15-inch rows for it to come back up to normal yield. And then it was fairly stable, if you can call that stable. And the 30-foot border was picked up where it left off. So soybeans and corn were both affected by the trees, probably for light competition. We took out the water, and we had 3 years of data, and we had two actually very wet years. So we know that water was not the limiting factor here. So it's probably light. Native warm season grass. As I said, we would burn this every spring and just make it thicker and thicker. So we decided that we would burn in the fall and the spring, compare that, and also do some disking. How many of you all have ever tried to disk an established switchgrass stand after you burned it? My gosh, you go out there the first time, you thought, what did I just do? I see nothing. You know, you barely see your disk track. So you got to disk it two or three times, because that root mass is tremendous. And of course, this is spring, it's wet, and it's true. Those native grasses held a lot of water. You know, I buried a tractor the first time, had to walk, of course, all the way back from the farthest part, as if I had my cell phone with me. But we dissed it to the point that you think, oh my gosh, I've knocked out all my grass. I mean, this looks bad. But as you might expect, that next summer, yeah, you get some grass, but you get also a lot of forbs coming up on their own. And sure, you get a little bit of a foxtail and some ragweeds, but it's amazing what you get coming up. In that you get a lot of partridge pea, you get a lot of coneflowers, you get a lot of different types that makes this a very good habitat compared to our non-managed ones. And we do this every year. We've had, what, up to 3 or 4 years now that we've burned it in the fall, and distant. And actually, I think the quality of the habitat is getting better and better each year. We get a lot of questions. Okay, tall fescue has kept us from eroding half our state away. And it's great for that, but it's not that great for wildlife. Can we use other alternatives? And one of them we thought would be Virginia wild rye. It's a cool season native grass, but normally grows along the fence rows. There's a selection called Quiver from the Quiver River in northeast Missouri that can take full sun. And we've had excellent results with growing that rather than tall fescue. It's a bunch grass, it gets a little bit taller, and it's great for wildlife, and the NRCS has been excited that it can also help prevent the erosion and be good for our waterways. So, how are we using this information? See me, I'm a forward-thinking person here. We can have our outreach and extension, our Master Naturalist program. We have Audubon Society comes out and does monthly quail count or bird counts. And the quail have gone from 2 coveys to 25 coveys in 7 years. And unfortunately, John will not let us hunt him. Legally. Yeah. But we've been very, very successful with this. And we also have an annual Bob White Quail Field Day where we show landowners what they can do on their own farms. And we work with Missouri Department of Conservation folks. We have Quail Forever. We have demonstrations. We even have an economist out there that shows the difference between doing CRP 33 versus a root plow versus taking that fence row out. So that was pretty neat. And we also extend this out to kids with FFA field days, to our local community, and even we keep going to where we have a fishing day. This has nothing to do with the wildlife, but we actually try to get this whole thing involved. He's been standing for about 2 minutes, so do you have any questions?
How do you move those slides without touching
it? I have no idea. I have ESP in, I think.
I'm going to tell our next speaker how they told me to deal with this.
Okay. But anything else? Come on, it wasn't that. Yes, ma'am.
What happens when you burn? Does that affect the population of bobwhites or whatever?
The question was, what happens when we burn? Doesn't that affect the bobwhites? Well, they go someplace else.
Oh.
They really do. I mean, when we torch people.
You let them know beforehand.
It's kind of fun to see the rabbits on fire running out of there. We have done a few of those. And sometimes the fires shift. One time we did a back burn, and that became our lead fire because the wind shifted. That was fun. We changed our objectives.
Okay. All right.